Okay, if you want to grab your Bibles and turn to John chapter 10, we'll actually be starting in John chapter 9, but the bulk of our time this morning, we're going to be in John chapter 10. We are studying, trying to look at, during this series of classes, some of the what are called the I Am statements of Jesus. And as you read, especially through the book of John, the Gospel of John, this is where you come across a number of these I am statements where we've already looked at Jesus saying, I am the bread of life and I am the light of the world. We're going to run out of time before we can cover everything. So today we're going to combine two of them, see how that goes. But basically they're in the same context. And so we're going to look at them together. But it's the idea that Jesus is using different metaphors to help us to have a greater understanding of who he is. You know, does Jesus give us life? Yes. But then he says, I'm the bread of life. And that just kind of broadens your mind and your perspective on what that means, that Jesus gives us life. And is Jesus the one who gives hope to the world? Is Jesus the one who opens the eyes of the blind? Yes. But then to say, I'm the light of the world. Here we are in a world of darkness. And so these different metaphors help us to grab a picture of Jesus that perhaps we wouldn't have if it was just a straight reading. That's the nature of figurative language, is it helps to broaden our perspective about things. So today we're going to be looking at two of them together. They're right in the same context. Jesus saying, I am the door. I am the door of the sheep, and I am the good shepherd. And those are both in John chapter 10. But as we've been doing in this study, before we get to the saying and then looking at the significance of it, we always like to look at the setting. What's going on? Anytime you study something in the Bible, let's put it into context. When you get over to John chapter 10, and perhaps when you hear John chapter 10, you think the Good Shepherd. That's a whole chapter there about shepherd and sheep. And so if you peg in your mind what a certain chapter is about, what's Hebrews chapter 11 about? It's about faith. What's 1 Corinthians 13 about? Love. John chapter 10, it's about shepherd and sheep. About Jesus is the good shepherd. But what's going on before that transpires? I want to back up and take you back to John chapter 9. What happens in John chapter 9? Maybe you've got a paragraph or a chapter heading, the beginning of the chapter. Jesus heals a blind man. Would you have liked to have seen that? Would you have liked to have been there? For any of his miracles, would you have liked to have seen him? Here is a man. Now, he's not just a blind man. What do we learn in John chapter 9 and verse 1? He's blind, but how long had he been blind? He had never seen a single solitary thing with his eyes in his whole life. How blessed we are. Now, some of us have to have glasses and contacts and some other aids to help us to see like we used to could, because we can't see as well as we used to could. But at least we can see. Here was a man who was never able to see in his life. And in John chapter 9, Jesus comes and sees this man, finds this man, and Jesus heals this man, gives him sight. He tells him in verse 7 to go and wash in the pool of Siloam. I wonder if you were the blind man and you thought, what are you talking about? Go wash in the pool of Siloam. I had a bath last week. That's good enough for me. What's the big deal? Why do I need to go and wash in the... sometimes individuals look at the requirement that the Lord has to be baptized for the forgiveness of sins, and they say, that doesn't make sense to me. That doesn't follow. What has water got to do with... Why do I have to go down in water? And that just... It doesn't connect. Suppose this man had said that. I don't get it, Jesus. I mean, if you can heal me, heal me. You can give me sight. Give me sight. Let's not play games here. What's the deal with the washing in the pool of Siloam? I don't get it. Don't see the connection. I'm not going to do it. Well, how would he have died? Yeah, he was. He would have died as blind as he was when he was born. But Jesus, as Betty says, is testing his faith. Are you going to do what I tell you to do? And so go and wash in the pool of Siloam. And in verse 7, it says he went and he washed. And he came back doing what? Seeing exactly what Jesus told him would happen. And so this man naturally becomes a believer in Jesus. And it's interesting. I know you've studied this chapter and you've seen the back and forth between this guy and the Pharisees. It's almost comical if it's not so sad to see what happens with this man and the Pharisees. Look in verse 10. The Pharisees said to him, "How were your eyes opened?" He answered and said, "A man called Jesus." He doesn't have a full understanding of who he is, but do you think he knows what happened to him? "A man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to the pool of Siloam and wash.' And I went and washed and I received my sight." He knew exactly what had transpired in his life. Look down at verse 15. Pharisees also asked him what? What do you have after the word "him"? They asked him again. It's a different translation to have different words, but I want you to see that word. They asked him again how he had received his sight. How many times are they going to ask him? Well, you're going to see about four or five times here in this chapter they do. How did you receive your sight? He said to them, "He put clay on my eyes and I washed and I see." Did his story change? Apparently, they're wondering if they're going to get some different information out of him. They say down in verse 16, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was division among them. Verse 17, they said to the blind man again. Boy, they're persistent. They're determined. They're ignorant. They're dumb. Why again? "What do you say about him? Because he opened your eyes." What's his answer? "He's a prophet." I mean, what other conclusion could somebody come to than he's a prophet? Drop down to verse 24. So they again called the man who was blind and said to him. You know, if you got the same phone call three times asking you the same question, would you be looking at the caller ID a little bit closer the next time and say, "Look, I'm tired of talking to you. I don't know what your deal is here." This guy's got caller ID. These Pharisees keep coming to him, keep asking him the same question. Give God the glory, they say this time. "We know that this man is a sinner." Verse 25, the man answered and said, "Whether he's a sinner or not, you're making accusations. I don't know. But here's something that I do know. I was blind and now I see." And I keep telling you the same story. Does this guy, he doesn't have a full understanding of who Jesus is, but he is believing exactly what had happened to him. Verse 26. So they said to him, "Again, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I told you already." Does your Bible have tone in it? Does it have a volume control? I told you already and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? Oh, they didn't like that. They did not. They're anything but his disciples. But he says, "Look, are you coming to me because you want to hear the good news again? Do you want to follow him and become his disciple?" And so down in verse 30, the man answered and said to them, after they're coming after him again, "Why, this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from, yet he's opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." Where do you think he's from? "I was born blind." You remember, we skipped over the verses where he went and asked his parents. It wasn't good enough to ask the man. We're going to go ask his parents, how has all this transpired? And the guy says, "Look, I may not know exactly who this man is, but I tell you, if he opened my eyes, there's only one person who can do that. And that's God." And so what did they do in verse 34? They answered and said to him, "You were completely born in sins and you are teaching us." And so they cast him out. That's what they had said they were going to do. Look at verse 22. In verse 22, his parents said these things because they feared the Jews, because the Jews had already agreed that if anyone confessed that Jesus is the Christ, he'd be put out of the synagogue. So, exactly what this man does. They fulfill what they had planned to do, and they cast him out of the synagogue. Look in John chapter 12 for a second. We weren't going to look at this, but look in John chapter 12. Look at verse 42. Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in Jesus. The rulers of the synagogue. Many of them believed in him, but... That's not a good word, is it? They believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they would not have anything more than faith. Is faith enough to save? Faith alone. If it has nothing else. In a religious world, and in this world that we live in today, where people try to say, well, faith will save you. You don't have to do, it's just faith alone that saves. Look at this. They believed him, but they were not willing to confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. Because they loved what in verse 43? They loved the praise of men more than they loved the praise of God. And so back in John chapter 9, this formerly blind man is now cast out of the synagogue. Look at verse 35. So now he can't go back in the synagogue. Now he can't go back among those people that he had known for so long. Verse 35, Jesus heard that they cast him out. What did Jesus do? Did he say, oh, tough luck, you know, that's just one of those things that happens. Just pull up your bootstraps and deal with it, kid. Move on. Well, some of that could have been all right, but he heard it, he went and found him. And he said to him, do you believe in the Son of God? He answered and said, well, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you. How long did it take for this man to believe it? Then he said, Lord, I believe. Did he have any evidence? Oh yeah, overwhelming evidence. And now he's getting the facts, the information to go along with the evidence that he had, and he puts it all together and says, Lord, I believe, and he worshiped him. And Jesus said, for judgment I have come into the world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be blind. Now, why did he say that? I've come into the world so that those who cannot see will be able to see, but those who will see will be blind. Is he talking about a physical sight here? He had given a physical sight. Well, it was prophesied that the Messiah would do that, that he would give physically blind, give them back their physical sight. But did Jesus have a greater purpose than something physical? He came to give those who are spiritually not able to see, to give them sight. But here were some people who believed that they could see, and he says, I've come to make them blind. Verse 40, some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words. You think Jesus was just saying verse 39 for the benefit of the formerly blind guy? Just saying it for his... I'm just telling you this information. Nobody else needs to know this. No, he's saying it for everybody's benefit. And so these Pharisees, you know, as much as we looked at them again and again and again, coming and asking the same question, they perceive something here. They perceive something and they say, excuse me, are we blind also? What are you saying? We're hearing what, are you calling us blind? And Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, we see. Therefore, your sin remains. Oh boy. Is that what the Pharisees wanted to hear? That you are blind and that you are in sin and I have come, but you are rejecting the one who is offering sight. And so when you get to John chapter 10, that now you see red letters at the end of John chapter 9 and red letters at the beginning of John chapter 10. This is just a flow of a conversation. It's not a new day. It's not a new month. It is a new chapter, but it's just a flow of a... Look in verse 6, where verse of chapter 10. Verse 6 says Jesus used this, New King James says, illustration. Anybody got something different than illustration? This figure of speech? Parable? Some translations may have the word proverb. Jesus, in verses 1 through 5, is going to tell them, he's going to tell them a parable. And the purpose of the parable is to try to encourage this man that he had just healed to not give in to these Pharisees. Would that be easy to do? Here's the ruling. Here are these ruling Pharisees. Here are these influential. Here are these. Boy, these guys know the law better than I do. I just need to listen to whatever they say. And Jesus tells this parable, one, to encourage this man to continue to follow Jesus and not worry about what these Pharisees are saying. And then he tells it not just for this man, but he does it to impress upon the Pharisees who Jesus is. And we may not see it initially, or we will, but we may not register that this is really a parable about a contrast. It's a parable about the true shepherd. It's about Jesus being the good shepherd, and that's what we know John chapter 10 to be. But the setting of this parable, or these sayings, helps us to say, this is Jesus drawing a contrast. And he's trying to draw a contrast between himself and these Pharisees. Between the true teacher and the, well, what's the opposite of a true teacher? Between the true teacher and the false teachers. And he wants this formerly blind man to see these things. He wants others who are there to see these things. And he wants it to register in the heart of these Pharisees who they are and what they are, and to see if something might be done to change the direction of their life. So that's the setting. When you get to John chapter 10, it's helpful to back up into John chapter 9 and say, what are we looking at here? But let's look. We're looking at two sayings of Jesus this morning. I am the door of the sheep, and I am the good shepherd. And what he does before he says any I am statements is he starts in verses 1 through 6 telling this parable of the sheepfold. And do you think these people knew what a sheepfold was? Think they'd ever seen one? Have you ever seen a sheepfold? You saw it in Sunday school, didn't you? You drew pictures, you colored pictures of it. You've probably seen some video or maybe some pictures online. Some of you have seen them in person. You think about a walled structure, a rock wall, stone walled structure that doesn't have a roof on it. It's open to the sky, but this walled structure that would have one opening, and apparently sometimes it would have a door on it, sometimes it would have a gate on it, and a lot of times it was just an opening where the sheep would go in and out. And so if there wasn't a door there or wasn't a gate there, how would the shepherd keep the sheep inside the fold? He'd lay across the threshold. There's no door there, no gate there to keep them in. Well, the shepherd would just lay down there and keep the sheep in. And not only is he keeping the sheep in, but what is he keeping out? He's keeping the wolves out. Now, those sheepfolds would usually have multiple flocks inside that one sheepfold. You'd have all these shepherds would be out in the field during the day, and they'd come in at night, and they'd just put all of their flocks inside of this structure, inside of these walls together. And they got all mixed up, right? No. Got all these sheep in there, and they all look the same. Can you tell sheep apart? No. We can. If you're a shepherd. Mickey can. Mickey's the only one in here who can tell sheep apart. The rest of us is just bah, it's just bah over there and a bah over there, and that's all we got. You could probably tell ones that are fat and ugly, next to ones that are scrawny and sickly. But I mean, if you've got hundreds of sheep, that's why maybe we come along and we tag them, right? Well, I'm going to put a tag on their ear and I'm going to put a red tag on mine. Well, you know that when those shepherds came in the morning to get their sheep, all they had to do was to call them. And those sheep would follow their shepherd. That's one of the strangest things. You think, because it's strange because we think about sheep and they're dumb. sheep are really dumb creatures. And that's true, and that doesn't make you feel good when the Bible describes God's people as sheep, right? It's like, okay. But sheep are not the brightest creatures in the world. You know, they put their nose down to the ground and they eat grass, and what are they paying attention to? Grass, duh. That's what they're concerned. They are oblivious to everything else in the world. But they know the shepherd's voice. And when he comes and calls it, the right sheep follow the right shepherd out of that fold. And so, did they know about shepherds back then? How often did the Old Testament talk about shepherds? Talked about them a lot. Were there any characters in the Old Testament who were shepherds? A lot. You got Abraham, you got Moses, you got David, and a number of Old Testament characters, obviously, who were shepherds. You have David describing God in that way. The Lord is my shepherd. And so when Jesus comes to tell this parable, the beginning of this chapter, these are things that they're very familiar with. But wasn't that the nature of all of his parables? He chose things that people were very familiar with. To be able to make a point with them. Now, again, this is a parable of contrast. He is contrasting himself with these Pharisees, but he's not going to talk about himself until after the parable. So what he's doing is he's contrasting the shepherd with the thieves and the robbers. So look at this parable. Most assuredly, I say to you, verse 1, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. Can you get that picture? You've got this walled structure where the sheep are. You've got this shepherd laying across the threshold, and you've got these thieves and these robbers who are climbing up some other way. Now, before we even get to the application of this, if you just read that one verse, Jesus, what are you talking about? Who had he just been talking to? Pharisees. Did they have a problem? Yeah, more than one. But here are individuals again and again and again and again. How did he heal you? What did he do? Who was this? They're not interested in hearing the truth. They're thieves and they're robbers, trying to climb up the wall and steal the sheep away from the shepherd. And so in the very first sentence of this parable, Jesus is nailing these people to the wall. Is it nice to call somebody a thief? Is it nice to call somebody a robber? That's what Jesus is calling them. Verse 2. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens. By the way, I don't know if we'll have time to get this to the significance of this saying this morning. Hopefully we will. But he who enters by the door is the... How many doors are there to this sheepfold? Only one. To him, verse 3, the doorkeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice. And he calls his own sheep. Does he say, hey, you ugly critters, come over here. He calls them by name. You give your pets names, don't you? Some of you give them nice names. Some of you don't give them such nice names. Anybody got 100 pets at home? Have you named all of your goldfish? Do you know them by name? They named their sheep. And so it's not just that they know his voice. They know the sound of their name coming from his lips. And he leads them out. When he brings out whose sheep? His own sheep. He goes behind them and drives them like a cowboy. Right? That's not what he does. He whips out his whip. No, he goes before them. And the sheep get in front of him and show him the way. The sheep follow him. Is this significant, the direction and who's in front? For they know his voice. Yet they will by no means follow a stranger. You have these different shepherds come in. They call their sheep. They're not going to follow a stranger, but they're going to flee from him. right? Stranger danger. That's what this verse teaches, right? Stranger danger. Here's a verse for your kids. They flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. Jesus tells this parable, and in verse 6 it says that the Pharisees did not understand it. Well, they didn't understand it. You think they had an idea who he was talking to? They already figured out at the end of verse 9, or the end of chapter 9 and verse 40, that when he was talking about blind people, they had already figured out, oh, he's talking about us. So if they'd already figured out, oh, blind people, that's us, when he starts talking about thieves and robbers, they didn't understand the parable. They didn't understand the message. They didn't understand the lesson to be learned. But do you think they had some idea, is he talking about us? You ever get in a situation where you thought somebody was talking about you? You weren't really sure what they were saying. Maybe they were speaking another language. You were in another country. And they were looking at you. They were laughing. They were pointing fingers. And you're like, what are you saying? You talking about me? You don't have a clue what they're saying. Because, you know, it's another language. Jesus is not speaking another language, but he is. He's speaking in parables. And they're like, wait a minute, is he talking about us? So he tells this parable about the sheepfold. And then in verse 7, what does he say? Most assuredly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. Are the Pharisees the door? No. They're the thieves and the robbers. And that's the contrast. That's the contrast that's being drawn in this parable. I am the door of the sheep. All who ever came before me are thieves and robbers, these Pharisees. But the sheep, the true sheep, the faithful sheep, they understand there's something missing here with these Pharisees. There's something not right about them. And so they don't follow them. Here's Jesus unafraid to identify somebody as a false teacher. Unafraid to say, look at these people who are selfishly motivated. Look in verse 10. The thief does not come except to. It's kind of a double negative, and you take a double negative, and if you take a double negative, what does the double negative make? A positive. So let's put this in a positive. The thief comes to do what? To steal, to kill, and to destroy. It's all about him. It's all about what he wants. Does he come in an honest fashion? No, he breaks in. He climbs up over the wall, and he's coming in not to give the sheep a special treat or to treat them kindly. He's coming in to steal and to kill. And Jesus says, that's what these Pharisees are. But the contrast is in verse 7. Look in verse 7 and verse 9. Verse 7, he says, I am the door of the sheep. And in verse 9, he says, I am the door. Now, again, That illustration about Jesus, what does that say about Jesus? What does it mean that he's the door? Can you gain entry into the sheepfold other than through Jesus? That's it. Does he provide safety, security for those who are inside? Do we need to understand that? The safety and the security that we have in Christ? But at the same time, as he's keeping those who are inside safe and secure, what is he doing about those who are outside? He's keeping them out. He's keeping the dangers away from his sheep. And so in verse 9, I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved. Who does Jesus let come in? If anyone enters. Is there partiality? Is he only going to, we're going to talk about this in a minute, but is he only going to let the Jews come in? If anyone enters by me, is there an entrance other than by me? No, that's the only one. But if he follows what I say by me and he enters by me, this one will be saved. And he will go in and out, and he will find pasture. he will have a rich and abundant life. And so that's what he says in verse 10. The thief does not come except to steal and to kill and to destroy. I have come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. What is that talking about? You know, I think sometimes our immediate thought is that's talking about heaven. Is there any more abundant life than heaven? I mean, that's the ultimate. That's the ultimate. But he's not talking about heaven. He's not using a future tense. He's not saying, I have come so that one day they will have life. Mm-mm. It's right now. This is a present tense verb. Jesus says, I've come so that they might have life right now and that they might have it more abundantly. What did he say about going in and out and finding pasture? The Christian life is the most abundant life to be had on this earth. And all of a sudden, people just start disagreeing with that statement. No. That's not true. I've seen people with a lot more than Christians. Yep, you're right. Because what do we look at? Material things. The Christian life is the most abundant life on this earth. To see that, hear that word in this context, to see that, you have to look at life differently than the rest of the world. If I look at life the way everybody else does, then I'm going to look at those material things. I'm going to look at wealth. I'm going to look at money and say, these are the people who have abundance. These are the people who have it made. These are the people that seem to have everything going for them. And if that's the way I look at life and look at the world, then I'm blind spiritually. But if I will open my eyes and allow the Lord and allow His Word to open my eyes, then I will see that the Christian life is the life that brings true joy, lasting joy, true peace, and lasting peace. Not this fake joy and this fake peace that can come and go in a materialistic world, but something that's true and abiding and lasting. And that's what he's talking about in verse 10. This ought to be one of our most comforting verses in John 10:10. By the way, you think about John 10:10. 10 is the number of perfection, isn't it? 10:10. This is a verse of perfection. What's the perfect verse? 10:10. And what does it say? If you're a Christian, you've got the perfect life. You've got the most abundant life that can be had on this earth. And that's what Jesus is offering. So when he says, I'm the door of the sheep, that's what he is saying. He's saying, you come unto me, and that's the kind of life that you can have. But then you get to verse 11. And we have this second saying, where he says in verse 11, I am the good shepherd. You think they understood what that meant? I am the good shepherd. You know, in the Old Testament, we already talked about Psalm 23, but Isaiah chapter 40 has got one of the coolest descriptions of God being a shepherd, where it talks about God, where it says he will feed his, think about this. It says about God, he will feed his flock like a shepherd. This is Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 11. He'll feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm. Can you do something else with your arm? Like to somebody you don't like? Like to an enemy? And the Bible talks about that arm of the Lord. But here the arm of the Lord is being used to gather his lambs. And he's not only going to feed them, he's not only going to gather them, he will carry them in his bosom. Does that say that he throws them in the wheelbarrow? He throws them in the cart. He sticks them in a sack and drags it behind him, throws it over his, he carries them in his bosom and gently lead those who are with young. So when Jesus comes along and says, I am the good shepherd, would the Jews have already had a mental picture of what that meant? Should have. Here's Jesus saying, that's who I... Now, put that in contrast with these Pharisees. Do you picture the Pharisees as gently carrying their followers along, carrying them in their bosom, and carrying... You don't picture that about the Pharisees, do you? And that's the contrast that Jesus is trying to draw between himself and the Pharisees. And so when you get to this passage, look in verse 11. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But a hireling. What's a hireling? You got a different word than the word hireling? Hired man? Hired hand? What's the difference between a hireling and the shepherd? Okay, you've got the owner of the sheep and you've got minimum wage guy. Okay? You've got the owner of the sheep and I just need a job to get by. And what does he care about the sheep? Well, a hireling who is not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep. What does that say about Jesus being the good shepherd? Does he own us? Who does not own the sheep? Sees the wolf coming. Well, at least he sees the wolf coming. I mean, could have his head buried in his iPhone and not even be looking up and see what's coming. So at least he sees the wolf coming. And then he sees the wolf coming and does what? I'm out of here. I'm gone. You're not paying me enough to care about that wolf coming. I am out. It leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf sees it, laughs his head off, catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he is a hireling. And he does not care about the sheep. In the first explanation of the parable, Jesus said, I am the door. And in contrasting himself saying, I am the door, he contrasted the Pharisees and said, the Pharisees are what? I'm the door and they're what? Thieves and robbers. Now in this explanation, he says, I am the shepherd. Okay, contrast. The Pharisees are the hirelings. Pharisees are the ones who don't care about you. Pharisees are the ones that they're not out for your best interest. If they're not out for your best interest, then whose best interests are they out for? Oh, they're looking out for themselves. Whatever they can get out of this and whatever they can bring unto themselves and make themselves better. Well, that's what they're interested in, is their own wages. They have no love for the sheep. But I want you to see what the good shepherd does in this context. We already saw it in verse 11 where he says the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. Look down at verse 15. Father knows me, so I know the Father. I lay down my life for the sheep. What does that sound? I lay down my life. Does that sound voluntary? Does that sound willing? Look in verse 17. Therefore my Father loves me because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down and I have power to take it again. What does that tell you about the love of Jesus? What does that tell you about the good shepherd? He lays down his life for his sheep. Back in verse 14, I am the good shepherd and I know my sheep. Now remember in the parable, he called his sheep by name. He knows his sheep. The Lord knows those who are his. The hireling, back at the end of verse 13, the hireling doesn't care about the sheep, but the good shepherd cares about the sheep. Verse 16, other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them I must gather, them I must bring. They will hear my voice. And boy, that verse has been so abused by individuals. All Jesus is talking about is the Gentiles. This verse has just been, and we've got 3.5 minutes. We can't have time to talk about how much it's been abused and people trying to define who that is. But Jesus is talking about the Gentiles. And he's saying, they're my sheep too. Other sheep I have, and I need to gather them in so that we can have, this is key at the end of verse 16, in case I don't get back to this, there will be one flock and one shepherd. Remember how many doors we saw? One door, one sheepfold. This says there is one flock. What's the flock? In New Testament explanation, what's the flock of God? The church. We are. How many flocks does God have? Just one. He only has one church. He calls the sheep. Look down at verse 26 and 27. Look at verse 27. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. He protects them. I give them eternal life, giving them, and they shall never perish. Neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand. Again, people have just abused this passage. Just what does it say? Neither shall anyone snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. Do you suppose that if a sheep, if you were carrying a sheep and that sheep wanted to get down, you think that sheep could get down? If you're carrying that sheep in your bosom, and you're just bosom buddies with this sheep, right? You're carrying him along, and all of a sudden that sheep wants to get down and out of your arms. Can that sheep get down and out of your arms? Anything that sheep could do to get free from you? Yeah. Did your kids ever do that? Yeah. So when this passage says, no one will be able to snatch them out of my Father's hand, absolutely true. But could somebody in the Father's hand, could a sheep wiggle his way out? I don't want to be here anymore. Kick against God and say, I'm done here. Well, is God going to force him to stay? No, the rest of the New Testament says just the opposite. But this context gives us a picture of Jesus being that good shepherd and what the good shepherd does for his sheep. So what's the significance? We don't have time. There's two slides on this. We don't even have time for this. But what's the significance? There's one fold. There's one shepherd. There's one door. When we come and look at this passage, we don't need to look for multiple folds of God, flocks of God, churches of God. God says there's only one flock. The end of verse 16, as many shepherds there are, is how many flocks there are. Ephesians chapter 4, as many lords as there are, is as many churches as there are. There's just one. Isn't that simple? Doesn't that make it easier? Jesus comes along, and in this period of contrast, he's trying to say to these Jews, listen up, you've got to make a choice. You've got to make a choice between their way that's going to lead to death and destruction, or the way, my way. And hopefully if we have time in this series of studies, we'll look at John 14 and verse 6. But these are some pretty interesting studies to look at the I am statements of Jesus and to see Jesus saying, I am the door and I am the good shepherd. And hopefully this has been beneficial. There's more on these slides if you want to grab them off the website tomorrow. There's some more information there if you want those for your study. Thank you all very, very much for your good attention this morning.